WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. A special WMRA investigation looks into recent turmoil at Mary Baldwin University amid shifting leadership and academic and faculty cuts. A bill in the General Assembly to overhaul control of the Virginia Military Institute undergoes significant changes. And Democrats advance legislation that would eliminate tax-exempt status for Confederate groups. This is the WMRA Daily for Thursday, February 12th. Mary Baldwin University, a small private college with campuses in Stanton and Fishersville, has been through a number of tumultuous changes in the past 6 months that prompted critique from faculty, students, and alumni. In a two-part report, WMRA's Randy B. Hagee looked into what happened and where the institution is heading now. Here's part one.
The last fall semester at Mary Baldwin started on an upbeat note, according to David McLeod, an associate professor of biology and the father of a current student. He attended an event with his daughter where students signed the school's honor pledge, and President Jeff Stein gave opening remarks.
It was encouraging, it was exciting, it was positive.
The next day, McLeod said he received an email saying Stein had resigned. This incident kicked off a maelstrom of changes made by university leadership and pushback from an academic community that had a slew of unanswered questions. The university announced on August 27th that the day before, Stein notified the Board of Trustees he would resign, and the board immediately confirmed Vice President and Dean of the College of Health Sciences, Todd Telmaco, as the new president. Just over a week later, the faculty passed a resolution of no confidence in the board, as the news leader reported. The board voted to discontinue 17 minors, many of them in the arts and humanities. Faculty members began to hear about colleagues being fired. Over the next month, an alumni group and several faculty groups released statements condemning these decisions. Students held a protest. A petition, which has since garnered more than 5,000 signatures, was published online to protect the school's liberal arts legacy. Then, the first week of the spring semester, the board announced Telmaco's resignation, effective at the end of June. WMRA interviewed three faculty members, a dean, and one of the board's co-chairs about this series of events. Regarding President Stein, professors describe a leader who was loved by the academic community.
Jeff Stein was the greatest thing to happen to Mary Baldwin University in 20 years.
Adrian Anderson is an assistant professor of biology.
Jeff's line was always all in for Mary Baldwin.
Stein was hired through a national search in 2023 when former president Pamela Fox retired after a 20-year tenure.
He was very connected to faculty.
Rebecca Haberman is an associate professor of biology and directs the School of Science.
Everything I had seen from him indicated that he was dedicated to the university, and a resignation seemed really out of the blue.
Fellow biology professor McLeod said once he got notice of Stein's resignation, he and other faculty went to the on-campus house where Jeff lived with his wife, Chrissy. She volunteered as director of the college's Writing Center and had just been named director of the Commons, a center for student support services.
Chrissy was obviously really upset, and Jeff was so focused on, he's like, it's about the students. That's why we're here.
He said Stein would not divulge what led to his resignation. McLeod reached out to the Steins with my interview request, which they declined, and the board hasn't revealed any reasons either. I interviewed co-chair Constance Derricks, who has served on the board since 2020 and is an Atlanta-based advisor to corporations and not-for-profits on high-stakes decisions. Derrick said she could not answer a number of my questions, including what led to Stein's resignation, if Stein signed a non-disclosure agreement, if Stein volunteered to resign or was asked to by the board, whether the reasons behind Stein's resignation were discussed with the full Board of Trustees or only within the executive committee, and why Telmaco was installed as a permanent rather than an interim president.
There's nothing about how, who, or what the board deliberated about that I can comment on.
She did explain that a plan of succession for the college presidency had been drafted over a year before these events.
There was in place an emergency plan for Todd to take over in the event that Dr. Stein was unable to do that. So that was a conversation between Dr. Stein and the board. That was not dictated.
In a faculty meeting on December 5th, according to a written version of his remarks provided to WMRA, Telmaco acknowledged that the loss of minors was painful, but ultimately directed and approved by the board, which is compelled to act by the university's mission and, quote, the financial realities facing our institution. But the professors I spoke with, including Kadrin Anderson, contend that cutting these minors doesn't save much money.
A lot of the majors that we still have, those courses still have to be taught.
A group of executive staff did provide input to the minors discussion.
My estimate this summer was that for adjunct pay, overload pay, additional expenses, that those minors probably cost us somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000 or $60,000 a year. That alone is absolutely not enough to justify eliminating minors.
Amy Deduck is the Dean of Institutional Effectiveness and the Gold College of Arts and Sciences. She noted it does make it easier to schedule courses if they're not tied to a specific timeline for a student to earn a minor.
Our students and our faculty value immensely the experiences that students have in the courses that are offered within those minors. We don't actually have a huge number of students enrolled in the majority of those minors. How do you sync up those two issues?
And here's part two of Randy's report.
Last November, Mary Baldwin's newly installed president, Todd Telmaco, told faculty that 17 minors were to be eliminated. Faculty, including Associate Biology Professor David McLeod, started hearing through the grapevine that colleagues were being let go.
We kind of learned by word of mouth who was getting cut.
Rebecca Haberman, also an Associate Professor of Biology, expressed this plea.
I think the board, or at least some top members of the board, have a vision for the university. I'd like to know what their vision is, whether I agree with it or not. And really, I want the rationale for the decisions that have been made.
The January 15th email sharing Telmaco's resignation also announced the reinstatement of four unnamed faculty members and four minors: African-American studies, art history, religious studies, and sexuality and gender studies. I asked Board of Trustees co-chair Constance Derricks about the extent of the board's role in eliminating faculty positions.
The board does not hire nor remove anyone other than the president. We're informed about a lot of things that aren't our decision as part of our oversight role.
And minors.
So the board must approve actions like that. The reason for bringing those back that we did was that we had more information. And that new information told us that that was the right thing to do.
She declined to say what that new information was. A university spokesperson declined to answer questions about the financial impacts of cutting minors and how many faculty members were let go last semester. So what is the university's financial position? The Augusta Free Press previously reported on an email Telmaco sent to alumni, which said the university held $18 million in debt and, quote, much of our Stanton and Fishersville campuses are pledged as security against our debt. According to a 2024 audit available online, the largest piece of this debt is just under $12.9 million in USDA rural development debt. Derricks confirmed to WMRA that this loan was part of the funding to build the Murphy Deming College of Health Sciences in Fishersville, which opened in 2014 and offers bachelor's and graduate level programs. The college's overall enrollment has fluctuated in recent years, according to their publicly available fiscal filings. It dipped to 1,250 around the start of the pandemic, rose to more than 2,200, and they currently claim 1,800 on their website. Dean Amy Deduck provided more context.
Murphy Deming's the easiest one to answer. The programs there have continued to be successful. We feel very, very strong about the future of graduate medical education. Online it's holding fairly steady and possibly increasing slightly. Undergraduate residential applications are up about 70% this year.
The board has directed university staff to look into selling or repurposing properties that are not central to the residential undergraduate experience, but their options are limited by the debt.
The covenants that are required by an agency like the USDA can restrict what you're able to do in the future. And the amount of debt Mary Baldwin has, based on our size, is not an egregious amount of debt. But, you know, when you have requirements that you can and can't do certain things, it just constrains your options.
Simultaneously, the board is now discussing how to hire a president for the third time in 3 years. I asked a university spokesperson if Telmaco would comment on his resignation and was sent a statement which read in part, quote, his decision was a personal one and he shared his appreciation for the opportunity to serve Mary Baldwin during an important period of transition. Looking forward, both Deduck and Derek shared their excitement for the Mary Baldwin Signature, a framework for the undergraduate program that sorts students into neighborhoods with special events based on their areas of study and connects incoming freshmen to professors, coaches, tutors, and one another.
We've got to get past this awful past semester of doom and gloom that, you know, the frustrations with the board and with the decisions that were made, because what we're seeing is the coalescing of so much work into these amazing positive experiences for the students.
We remain rooted in tradition, but we are designed for transformation.
Despite their frustrations with the institution last semester, biology professors McLeod and Anderson expressed an unwavering dedication to the students.
They're like the nicest human beings, the kindest human beings you could ever want to have. And I've never worked with a group of faculty who are more dedicated to those students.
I just hope that they know that we're doing everything we can because we care so deeply about them and want to see them succeed no matter what.
Mary Baldwin has, for years, prided itself on the upward rungs of potential it offers to college students with limited opportunities, those from lower-income families and the first in their families to pursue higher education. Now, the institution must climb that ladder itself. For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Hagee.
You can find a longer version of this report at WMRA.org and on our app. A bill to put the Virginia Military Institute under the control of Virginia State University has been altered and is on the way to the House floor after a vote early Wednesday. Virginia Public Radio's Brad Kuttner has the details.
Virginia Beach Democratic Delegate Mike Fagan's VMI effort started over concerns linked to a 2021 state report about how the first state-supported military college in the country handled race and history. But a visit to the school over the past weekend and conversations with those involved saw Fagan's effort, which aimed to change management of the school to the historically black Virginia State University, watered down. It now only deals with how VMI's leadership is appointed. Here's Fagan's.
VMI has made great strides over the past 4 years. Their leadership acknowledges that the troubling findings that was identified in 2021 and has committed to continued improvement. Those efforts matter, and we appreciate the conversations, but there is still much work to be done.
Now the bill, according to Fagan's, puts VMI in a, quote, balanced position. The total number of board members won't change, but the number of those with senior military experience has been increased. It was a compromise VMI Superintendent Lieutenant General David Furness said he supported. Furness also gave credit to General Cedric Wins, the school's first black superintendent, who was appointed by former Governor Ralph Northam but not renewed last year.
My predecessor, General Wins, made significant progress, and I intend to continue that progress going forward. You have my word on that.
The bill now heads to the floor chamber.
The House of Delegates passed a bill on Tuesday that would eliminate tax-exempt status for groups associated with the Confederacy. The legislation would require six groups, including the Virginia Division of the United Daughters of the Confederacy, to pay real estate and personal property taxes. The General Assembly is also considering a bill that would eliminate license plates with logos related to the Confederacy. Virginia has had a ban on public employee union bargaining for decades. Democrats in the majority 4 years ago loosened that ban and allowed localities to opt in to such bargaining agreements. Now, the ban could be fully repealed. Brad has that report.
Every public employee in Virginia may soon be able to engage in collective bargaining if an effort in the House of Delegates survives floor votes in the coming days. Some public college employees gathered at the Virginia General Assembly building ahead of the vote. Among them was Steph Gunst, administrative coordinator of the University of Virginia and member of the United Campus Workers of Virginia.
We know that universities will lobby and fundraise to the tune of billions of dollars for what is important to them, and we hope that will include resourcing the workers to provide the high-quality research and education that is our mission.
At a subcommittee hearing, other public employees like firefighters, preschool teachers, and staff of the state's Department of Corrections all joined in supporting the effort. But Lauren Stewart with Americans for Prosperity said the effort was rushed and could cost localities money they don't have.
The current fiscal impact analysis is very limited and does not reflect the diverse localities in Virginia, the cities, the counties, and towns.
The fiscal impact statement released with the bill puts the price tag of the effort in the tens of millions. A Senate version is also working its way through the chamber. As for Governor Abigail Spanberger, she said no to a full repeal of the state's union limiting right to work law. However, during her State of the Commonwealth address, she said, quote, being pro-business and pro-worker are not mutually exclusive.
One part of Virginia Democrats' affordability agenda is access to contraception. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope has more.
Like many young women who become unexpectedly pregnant, Janika Fernandez did not know what to do. She decided to have an abortion.
I wish I'd had access to contraception so I wouldn't have to make the choice between my career that I wanted to pursue and putting my child in the same environment that my mother had to fight so hard to keep us out of, all because I did not have contraception.
Now she's speaking out in favor of the Right to Contraception Act, which passed the Senate this week with a bipartisan vote. The bill prohibits the restriction of the sale, provision, or use of contraceptives. Three Republican senators voted in favor of the bill, which was introduced by Senator Jennifer Carroll Foy, a Democrat from Prince William County.
I believe that many of those Republicans did it because it's the right thing, and other ones, for whatever reason, did not. And they will have to answer to that in their communities when girls and women ask those questions as to why are you impugning or infringing on my rights.
Last year, Governor Glenn Youngkin vetoed the bill. This year, Governor Abigail Spanberger is expected to sign it.
The General Assembly is considering a bill to crack down on people who have not paid state taxes. And the debate has a partisan dimension. Michael has the details.
This is a bill that I got from George W. Bush.
That was the majority leader of the state Senate, Scott Surovell, a Democrat from Fairfax County. He was speaking about a bill he introduced that would help Virginia identify people who have not paid state taxes by awarding money to anyone who blows the whistle on tax cheats.
It's a proven federal model that the Fed's been using now for almost 20 years. And this just allows us to do the same thing at the state level with this good Republican idea. So I'd hope we can see a good bipartisan vote on this good Republican idea.
But that's not what happened. After the majority leader presented his bill to the Senate, Republicans, Senator Mark Obenchain of Rockingham County, took to the floor to say this.
Why would we do this? Do you really think the IRS and the Virginia State Department of Taxation needs this kind of help? I think they do a pretty doggone good job sniffing out tax fraud on themselves. What we're doing is energizing a bunch of disaffected spouses in divorce contests or neighbors in boundary disputes, digging up mischief on their neighbors.
The bill passed on a party line vote, and now it's heading over to the House of Delegates. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
Virginia's rapid expansion of gambling has led to several bills to create a gaming agency to help regulate the industry, and Governor Spanberger appears to be on board with the effort. Brad Kuttner reports.
When bills move through Virginia's legislature, the governor can and often does send representatives of their administration to signal support or disinterest in the effort. According to those familiar with the admin's workings so far during the 2026 session, much of the input has been kept to bills related to Governor Abigail Spanberger's so-called affordability agenda. But in a rare move Tuesday, Secretary of Agriculture and Forestry Katie Frazier spoke in favor of a House bill that would create one agency, a new gambling commission, to consolidate and regulate the state's growing gambling industries.
Our patchwork approach is inefficient. It creates gaps in oversight and makes it more difficult to protect consumers, collect reliable data, and ensure fair and responsible gameplay. Governor Spanberger is deeply concerned about any discussions of gaming expansion in Virginia without first establishing a single entity with clear authority, consistent standards, and strong compliance and enforcement capabilities.
Frazier's comments come after a Senate version of the Gambling Commission bill faced some amendments earlier Tuesday, though the nature of those changes was not yet clear. Frazier, who did not speak in favor of the Senate version, did refer to each chamber's efforts as, quote, different. And what does Frazier's comments mean for skill games and iGaming, two forms of gambling that are already in the Commonwealth but with debatable legal status? In a text message, Delegate Paul Krizik, architect of the Gaming Commission effort in the House, said, quote, any new gaming will wait till we have established centralized regulatory body. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Virginia's NAACP chapter has announced the death of former executive director King Salim Khalfani. The civil rights champion led the organization for 16 years from 1998 to 2014. He advocated against the death penalty and solitary confinement for people imprisoned in Virginia. Khalfani died Monday at the age of 66. Finally today, February is Heart Health Month, and the American Heart Association hopes their traveling CPR kiosk can turn bystanders into lifesavers. Kayris Manzanares with VPM News has the details.
A new CPR kiosk has been showing up in everyday places like universities and grocery stores around Richmond. It gives people the chance to practice life-saving chest compressions. The kiosk's first stop was at the market on 25th in Richmond's East End last fall. The machine's now at Virginia Commonwealth University. Michelle Nastai with the American Heart Association says 90% of people who experience cardiac arrest outside of a hospital do not survive.
We know that CPR can double or even triple those survival rates. So we are trying as the American Heart Association before the year 2030 to double those survival rates from cardiac arrest in every community.
The mobile kiosk will be hosted at 9 places across Central Virginia over the next 3 years.
Kayris Manzanares reporting for WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening. And I hope you enjoy your Thursday.